Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the worst cyclone or hurricane in the history of the Pacific, which struck the island chain of Vanuatu with winds up to 180 miles per hour. Claire Pascal, a fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, and author of Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map, joins us from the Pacific island of Tonga to discuss the impact of global warming on the tiny island nations of the Pacific and the roles of regional powers like New Zealand and Australia, who are coming to the aid of Vanuatu, as well as the growing influence of China in the region. And then we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela, to speak with Antonio Gonzalez, the president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., about the White House's recent designation of Venezuela as an extraordinary threat to U.S. national security, and the rejection of this claim from representatives of the 12-nation South American bloc UNASUR meeting in Ecuador, as well as criticism the U.S. is getting from members of Venezuela's opposition who oppose Obama's actions as inappropriate. Then finally, with Vladimir Putin missing for over 10 days as rumors are rife of an FSB coup that has neutralized him and speculation swirls that he is attending the birth of a love child in Switzerland, we will discuss the extent to which the left in Europe and the US has been drinking the Kremlin's Kool-Aid ladled out by Putin's English language propaganda network RT. John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, The Kremlin's Kool-Aid, and why apologists for Putin in the West can't keep two thoughts in their heads at the same time. One, that NATO expansion has backfired, and two, that Putin is a gangster. And joining us now from the island of Tonga in the Pacific is Claire Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, and a consultant to the US Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and the author of Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. Welcome to Background Briefing, Claire Pascal.
Hi.
And Claire, apparently aid is arriving from Australia and New Zealand into Port Vila, the capital of Vanuatu. But the outlying islands, there's some doubt as to whether aid will reach there for some time. And there's also no understanding of the casualties. But it's pretty clear that this monstrous cyclone, hurricane, packing winds of up to 180 miles an hour is the worst in the history of the Pacific, and it's pretty inescapable that it has something to do with climate change.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to tie a specific weather event to global climate change, but it's the region is starting to see more of these extremely unusual events. Here in Tonga, they had the largest cyclone they've ever seen last year, which did massive damage to one of the islands, Hapai. So this is kind of the second in as many years storms that has had a major national impact on, in this case, possibly three nations. So it's affected Vanuatu, Tuvalu, and Kiribati so far as well.
And as it happened, Vanuatu's president, Baldwin Lonsdale, was attending the World Conference on Disaster Risk and Reduction in Japan when the hurricane struck. What's your sense of whether the nations at that conference, we know that Australia and New Zealand are sending aid via their Hercules transport planes, but clearly the reports indicate that all of the infrastructure is down. One of the outlying islands, Tanna, has been devastated. This is a major, major disaster, and I guess with the president out of town, even he can't get back to the island. So it sounds like there's sort of nobody in charge.
There's a lot of community action going on, but coordination is very difficult. There's a communications blackout. I think the main airport at Port Vila has been affected, so getting major supplies directly into some of the hardest hit major urban area. I mean, the major Port Vila is about 50,000 people, so this is a country that has population spread out over very wide areas. Of course, the immediate concern will be clean water because you don't want the secondary effect of things like cholera to start to hit. There is a concerted effort by all involved. The region is training for events like this now, and Australia in particular has really stepped up. They've committed $5 million immediately, and as you mentioned, the military is involved in trying to get urgent supplies to people who need it. There are generally two phases to this sort of emergency. You've got the immediate response, and then you have the long-term rebuilding. The long-term rebuilding brings in a whole different set of factors that might complicate the reconstruction of the economy of the country somewhat. That's when you start to get this whole kind of development complex coming in, and it can get quite tricky at that point.
And again, I'm speaking with Clea Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical, security and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She's a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant to the United States Department of Energy, NATO and the OSCE, and author of Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. But already, Vanuatu has repeatedly warned it is already suffering devastating effects from climate change, with the island's coastal areas being washed away and forcing resettlement to higher ground and smaller yields on traditional crops. So that's, I take it, and the work that you're doing in Tonga is along those lines, is it not? Haven't the island nations, in the Pacific island nations, been rattling the cage of the UN for the longest time, talking about global warming and the extent to which they're going to become extinct because of it?
Yeah, and when we talk about things like sea level rise, so we'll talk about a country, for example, Tuvalu, which was also hit by PAM. So Tuvalu has extremely low lying. The highest elevation is about 6 or 9 feet above sea level. And so people traditionally say, well, you know, if you get 6 feet sea level rise, then the country will disappear. Well, it has the potential to be killed long before then through events like this. Because if the salt water gets into the freshwater lens and contaminates the freshwater lens, the vegetation can die. The vegetation is what's holding the earth in place. It creates an accelerated erosion. And then things can wash away very quickly with the next storms or king tides, things like that. So they're saying now in Tuvalu about 45% of the population has been affected. One island has been completely flooded, and it's very difficult to know whether they'll be able to move back. And then you're starting to get into issues of resettlement of entire populations. And that leads not only, obviously, to distress, individual distress, but also very serious legal questions, because they might be small countries in terms of population or land mass, but every tiny island can have up to 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone around it, the sort of thing that we're seeing in the South China Sea. So if Tuvalu has to shift, if the population has to abandon that territory, the question is, does that then become international waters? You know, does the country legally cease to exist? Does that mean another nation, for example, you know, China, which is moving into the region quite effectively, can say, we'll give you, the Tuvaluans, you know, a certain amount of money to relocate, and we're going to keep one of your islands and build a military base on it and use that to so-called protect your exclusive economic zone, but then they essentially have a base in the middle of the Pacific. So the strategic implications start to cascade very quickly, which, of course, doesn't diminish the human cost that we're seeing immediately. But in the rebuilding effort, taking all these other things into account is going to become incredibly important.
Well, recently, Clea Pascal, there was a release from the huge cache of secrets that Edward Snowden got from the NSA intercepts from New Zealand, which is a part of the Five Eyes program, of the extent to which they're monitoring activities in these Pacific islands, and in particular the activities of China. So tell me about China's move into this area. How overt is it, and how do they operate?
China has a very competent foreign policy. I wouldn't say it's brilliant, but it's competent, and it's competent. Competent is enough, because unfortunately the Western allies have been so heavy-handed in the region that the region has been forced to look for other partners. So Within the last 10, 15 years, for example, China has taken over about 90% of the retail sector here in Tonga. There's discussions about building a slipway for which essentially has the potential to be expanded into a Chinese port here. And part of this quick development by China comes from the fact that the islanders, Pacific Islanders, especially the leadership, feel very looked down upon by Australia and New Zealand. In the case of the recent revelations, what's become clear is that every single electronic communication in the Pacific Islands and several other countries as well, but specifically the Pacific Islands, is being monitored. So every telephone call, every text message, every email, every website visit is being logged by New Zealand. And there is no, terrorist threat coming out of Tuvalu. There's no Al-Qaeda cell in Nuku'alofa. The advantage seems to be, from some of the articles coming out in the New Zealand Herald, that this is an economic advantage issue. So when the trade negotiators from the region go into, for example, the Pacer Plus negotiations, Wellington has dossiers on all of the main negotiators and, whether their kids need to be educated in New Zealand or whether they have medical issues or whether they're in debt, where are the weaknesses in the telecom system. Communication costs are very expensive. Energy costs are very expensive. When you look into these sectors, there usually are people from Australia and New Zealand involved. So this is one of the issues. Australia currently, for example, is doing a great job in trying to help out Vanuatu, but during the rebuilding process, if it doesn't provide a kind of equitable deals, if they don't come in and try to restructure the economy as a result, then it may just end up pushing Vanuatu closer to China, which will offer a better deal, loans with better concessions, that sort of thing.
So in other words, the regional powers, Australia and New Zealand, have been terrible colonists, and they've managed to annoy the locals or basically turn them off, and they're turning to China. That's the broader picture.
That's right. And it's not, countries tend not to like to deal with China. These are very Christian countries. Family is very important. There's no kind of natural cultural compatibility with, the people of the Chinese Communist Party. But they need to survive, and they need to provide for their people. They need to build roads. And these economies have been dealt with like kind of economies to suck money out of. So the Australian New Zealand will talk about how much aid they pump into the Pacific, but a vast amount of money goes out of the Pacific and into Australia and New Zealand, much, much more than the aid that goes in. And currently, both of those countries have folded their aid agencies into their departments of foreign affairs and trade. So it is explicit that aid is a component of foreign policy and trade policy. So a lot of the investment that you see, for example, here in Tonga, New Zealand put in a solar plant, but that solar plant in the contract with the New Zealand government has to transfer money back to New Zealand every year. And that national energy company in New Zealand that put in the plant was trying to use the Tonga plant to up its sales price when it floated the company and went public. So there's a lot of really kind of peculiar economic relationships with the countries of the Pacific. And they've been so damaging to the economies of the Pacific that they've had to look elsewhere. And personally, I think it's extremely bad policy, because if they would allow these economies to flourish, the money would flow into Australia and New Zealand at a much greater rate. So they're looking at narrow, short-term economic interests at the cost of the general economic growth of the whole region over the longer term.
Well, just in closing, Clea Pascal, I just saw there's a new series here on HBO called Vice, which is a news and current affairs series somewhat along the lines of CBS's 60 Minutes, but far much more edge to it, much better. And they did a piece where they went down to the Antarctica with scientists from NASA who have their own big plane that flies low over the entire Antarctic subcontinent and maps the ice in a very accurate way. And it was so alarming. I cannot tell you the consensus from these scientists. They were just screaming to the rooftops. This is a catastrophe. It's melting so much faster than we realize. And you saw the rocks underneath these vast, you know, hundreds of feet high slabs of ice that are about to break off and slide into the ocean. So the takeaway from this was that the global warming is in much, much worse than anybody even wants to talk about. That was clearly the result. So if this is true, then these islands have got to be screaming from the rafters as well.
They are, but they, you know, so should be Miami, and so should be, Amsterdam, and so should be. I mean, you know, we are all in this together, and we need to deal with this very quickly. And mitigation, I'm not quite sure how much is going to help. We've got feedback mechanisms kicking in at this point: CO2 saturation in the ocean, methane release from the permafrost. You know, that have the potential to accelerate things very, very quickly. So yes, this needs to be a priority. We have structural problems with dealing with things like this. We are not good at long-term planning. We're not good at taking a short-term economic realignment for a longer-term economic benefit. So I don't know structurally, I don't know how we're going to do it. Everybody has to be involved. The insurance sector has to be involved. Zoning regulations have to be involved. The energy sector obviously has to be involved. It's not one problem. It's a million problems, and it's going to require a million solutions.
I thank you so much for joining us, Cleo Pascal.
Pleasure. Thanks. Good to talk to you again.
And again, I've been speaking with Cleo Pascal, who's in Tonga in the Pacific. She specialized in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She's a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant to the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and author of Global Warming: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to Caracas, Venezuela.
Freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Antonio Gonzalez, the president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voting participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. During Gonzalez's tenure, the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project has nearly tripled Latino registrants from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 14 million in 2014, and he currently appears as a regular commentator on the Public Radio International's Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles called Strategy Session. And he's Time Magazine named Antonio Gonzalez as one of the 25 most influential Hispanics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Antonio Gonzalez.
Hi, Ian. It's a pleasure being with you.
And you are down in Venezuela, in the country that recently Obama designated as an extraordinary threat to U.S. national security. How threatened do you feel, or should we feel?
I think it's the other way around, Ian. Venezuela was declared an imminent threat to the national security of the United States by President Obama in a bit of twisted logic. I understand that this is part of an American legal process that allows the U.S. government to sanction individuals from other countries, which President Obama did. Seven generals and judges, interestingly, that the U.S. is accusing of human rights violations. But in Venezuela, this has been taken as a virtual declaration of war. Today was a massive, massive anti-imperialist demonstration where hundreds of thousands of people have filled the streets of Caracas. The TV networks are full of declarations by distinct and diverse government officials and community leaders, partisan leaders, basically denouncing President Obama and preparing for a U.S. invasion. So it is, you know, in the United States, this has gone barely noticed because I guess Americans are numb, a bit numb to the notion of the United States intervening in other countries' affairs. But in Venezuela, which is a highly organized country, this is considered to be a pretext for invasion. And I would argue in Latin America as well, there was a emergency meeting of the what's called UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations, which categorically rejected President Obama and rejected the United States and denounced the declaration of Venezuela as a national security threat and basically said, we are standing with Venezuela in any instances of U.S. intervention. Very serious thing going on.
Well, not only did the 12-nation South American bloc UNASUR meeting in Ecuador condemn and reject the claim by the U.S. that Venezuela is an extraordinary threat to U.S. national security, also there have been criticism from members of Venezuelans' opposition who oppose Obama's actions as inappropriate. So, I mean, that's pretty extraordinary.
Well, it is smart, but it hasn't been unanimous by the Venezuelan opposition. There are other statements from Venezuelan opposition siding with President Obama. And the effect of this, I wager, Ian Masters, is that the Venezuelan government, Nicolas Maduro, the president since the famed nationalist leader Hugo Chavez died of cancer more than a year ago, has been saying, in part as a justification for poor economic performance, that the United States is destabilizing Venezuela. He's been saying that. The opposition has been saying, it's not true, it's not true. The U.S. has been saying, it's not true, it's not true. But President Obama's declaration has, in effect, said, it is true. We are destabilizing you, and we may take military action, which is what the declaration reportedly gives him legal authority to do. If a country is an imminent national security threat, U.S. laws since 2001 allow the president to take a preemptive military action. And this is what has, caused, at least for the moment, I'm on the street here, at least for the moment, people that I know that are very critical of the government to say, you know what, I'm now a Chavista because the effect of the Obama declaration is to create a nationalist, pro-government, pro-Venezuela backlash among the population, which is divided. Let's be honest. There's a lot of criticism of the government. There's a lot of support for the revolution, too. But you do see a reaction of maybe Venezuelans that are not that political, that are not that Chavista, siding with their government in the threat of a country, the United States, which is famous for intervening militarily, not only in the Middle East, but especially in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Well, that's what I mean. It's so boneheaded that even the opposition now is criticizing, or at least elements of the opposition are criticizing Obama. So what can you figure out, Antonio Gonzalez? Why did Obama do this? Because he's not necessarily, he's certainly not John McCain or George W. Bush, but he's acting like both of them. And the only theory that I've heard that makes any sense, because he's really rolled over for Marco Rubio and these Cuban-American diehards who somehow think that the 50-year blockade of Cuba has been a success. That the deal is that it for Obama to get them off his back to make the deal with Cuba and to take Cuba off the terrorism list that they certainly don't deserve to be on, that he had to throw a bone to Rubio and company over Venezuela. That's the only explanation I've heard. Not that I don't know that that's the correct one, but what have you heard?
I've heard three completely independent conspiracy and theory rumors of this action by the president. The first is that simply, you know, there is a tremendous relatively autonomous, imperialist nest in the State Department and the Pentagon. They're very powerful. They're very influential. They've had a constant tug of war with President Obama, and he was, in essence, pressured to do this and underestimated its implications in Latin America. He has been known to make ham-handed gestures, living in the bubble that he does, in which state and the Pentagon are overwhelmingly the counter force to the White House, as power, you know, a fourth co-equal branch in the United States. That's one theory, that he was simply muscled into this. The second theory is exactly what you're saying, that he's done so much. Pause there. Done so much to respect Cuba, and the State Justice Department. Justice Department. I'll correct myself. Has also prepared to try the number one Democratic nemesis that Obama has, Bob Menendez, the Cuban Democratic liberal imperialist. It seems like a contradiction in terms to some people, but Menendez has been for overthrowing the Cuban government forever, and he's everyone knows that he hates President Obama, and I assume the thing is mutual.
And he's also a big supporter of Netanyahu, right? And he's
opposed the president's Iran policy, slavish to Israeli Netanyahu administration. He's just the arch rival to President Obama within the Democratic Party. So these two sort of, you know, Obama did gave two for the liberals, and now he's throwing Venezuela under the bus for the conservatives. That's essentially your theory. And the third theory by Obama lovers, and there are some still, is that Obama is so smart and so ten steps ahead in the global chess game that he wanted to strengthen Venezuela by pretending to attack them. And I don't know which one of those is true, but the third one sounds true in the effect. Obama's measures are strengthening the revolution. They are strengthening support for President Maduro. They are mobilizing what was a demoralized Chavista grassroots network. And you know, the Venezuelan opposition has never been very smart or organized, but this is a not a death blow, but this is a body blow to them. They were expected by many to be in position to take over the Congress in the elections later this year. This is a disastrous step for them.
Well, Antonio Gonzalez, it's possible that Theory 1 and Theory 2 are correct. Theory 3 sounds a little off the wall to me. But I know that there's a residue, a block of hardline anti-Castro conservatives that have over the decades joined the Pentagon and particularly joined the CIA. You know, we know about this guy Rodriguez, who was the champion of torture, who took over, moved from the Latin American branch of the CIA to head up the Middle East branch, even though he doesn't speak Arabic. So this has been going on for some time. So I think you're absolutely right on the first, and I don't see the first and the second being mutually exclusive.
Well, just to you underscore your point, your listeners should really look up Tom Hayden's new book on Cuba, "Listen, Yankee: The Story of the Cuban Revolution." I believe it's entitled, because in there he has interviews with the people that did the very quiet diplomacy that's been going on for 2 years that led to the president's reversal of American policy on Cuba, which is still undergoing and, you know, in fits and starts, but, you know, absolutely reverberated in the U.S. and around Latin America and the Caribbean. In there, Tom Hayden's sources explicitly say the reason for their uber secrecy was to evade the Cuban Miami exile plants that have occupied the State Department and Pentagon and who are absolutely would have revealed and blocked the Obama reconciliation move with Cuba. They had to be secret because they are state and the Pentagon are so infiltrated with Cuban exile counter-revolutionaries.
So has this, though, this move by Obama, which clearly is ridiculous hyperbole that Venezuela is an extraordinary threat to U.S. national security, all the while the United States is paying cash for Venezuelan oil, which I think is one of the top suppliers of foreign oil to the United States. And that's clearly being unaffected by this, you know, manufactured hysteria that this tiny country is a threat to the United States. But has Obama's move in any way jeopardized the recent opening to Cuba?
I think that absolutely it has. Cuba immediately denounced Obama's declaration and was a leader in the was a present at the UNASUR emergency meeting. And there's also an emergency meeting of the ALBA countries, which is sort of the truck passing by. Hold on 1 second. The ALBA countries are an alliance of the more Chavista governments in Latin America. It's about 10 countries, including Cuba, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador. They are loudly denouncing the move. If the president deepens his threats, I would expect the Cuba reconciliation process to stall. I predict that this response in Venezuela and throughout the Americas, and hopefully in the United States, a number of us are hoping to initiate a hands-off Venezuela campaign. We're discussing that now. That this will cause the president to walk back, at least in practice, his threat and allow the Cuba negotiations to go forward. There is a very important meeting next month of all of the countries of the Americas, and this meeting will go very bad for the United States and in particular for Mr. Obama if it isn't clarified by then that the United States has no intention of conducting some kind of direct or indirect military aggression against Venezuela. So I would give this about 3 weeks to get resolved in the positive, positive being clear signals that no further aggression will take place against Venezuela. Or we're looking at major setbacks, sad setbacks to the Cuba reconciliation process and to U.S. Latin America relations in a context of hopefulness that was unleashed on my birthday, December 17th, 2014.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us from Caracas, Venezuela, Antonio Gonzalez.
Thank you, Ian. It's always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Antonio Gonzalez, who's the president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. He currently appears as a regular commentator on the Public Radio International's Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles. Strategy sessions heard Mondays at 4 p.m. Time magazine named Gonzalez as one of the 25 most influential Hispanics in America. We're going to take a brief station break. Back looking at why the political left drinks the Kremlin's Kool-Aid. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Pfeffer, who is the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously, he worked as an associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. His books include Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy After 9/11, and Crusade 2.0. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Kremlin's Kool-Aid. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Pfeffer.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And John, every time I cover events in Russia and particularly in Ukraine, I do get blizzards of mail saying that I should talk to sort of pro-Russian people for a different perspective. And, you know, I have spoken with Stephen Cohen and John Mearsheimer and others who've made points not so much from a knee-jerk pro-Russian position, but mostly from a, as you do in your article, by the way, in the Huffington Post, an alarm at how the eastward expansion of NATO has led to this. And it was all very clear. And as you point out in your article back in 1996, you wrote a piece about warning about NATO expansion eastward. But that doesn't get Putin off the hook, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I should emphasize that I too am pro-Russian. I mean, I've studied Russia, I studied Russian, I've spent time in the country, and it's precisely because I'm pro-Russian that I'm so upset at what is happening in the country, upset at what is happening under Vladimir Putin. And, you know, he's not the absolute worst that Russia has ever produced as a leader, but he certainly has, you know, consolidated his power. He has jailed and marginalized and possibly as well killed members of the opposition. He is about as far to the right on the political spectrum as you can get in terms of his authoritarianism, in terms of his social policy, even in terms of his economics. And so his policies overall are very upsetting to even, and it should be upsetting to even the most pro-Russian of people.
And the people that he is making alliances with in Western Europe should be troubling to European and American leftists. The fact that Putin is helping finance the French right-wing party of Le Pen, Jobbik in Hungary. And I've never quite understood what that strategy is there. But, you know, when he rides around on motorcycles with motorcycle gangs who are incredibly racist and homophobic, he uses the Orthodox Church as a way of wrapping himself in sanctimony. And, of course, the Pussy Riot girls played right into his hands in that regard. You know, you'd have to, in the American context, you'd have to compare Putin to, say, Rick Santorum with John McCain's level of testosterone multiplied by 100.
Yes, and I mean, the only difference could possibly be that it's not clear that Putin actually believes any of these things. It's unclear what his feelings really are about, you know, gay and lesbian issues or Orthodox Church. It's very possible that he's just using these as Stalin did, frankly. There's a famous speech, the Mother Russia speech of Stalin, when it was obvious that people were not going to rally around the Soviet flag during World War II as a result of communism, but they might do it if Stalin appealed to their nationalist sentiments. And so Putin, I think, clearly is in that tradition. Now, as to why he is in supporting the far right in Europe, it really boils down to the fact that the far right in Europe is Euroskeptical of the European Union. And if they were to come to power in France, the National Front, in England, the UK Independence Party, these parties would, if not withdraw their countries from the European Union, at least weaken the European Union. And so I think that is part of a kind of geopolitical strategy on Putin's part to, if you will, divide and conquer. The EU as a whole is quite a powerful institution. But if it were divided up according to the preferences and policies of the individual members, it'd be much easier for Russia to deal with them when it comes to energy policy, when it comes to military policy, when it comes to relations with Eastern Europe, and of course, former Soviet Union.
Well, but Putin basically, as much as eastward expansion of NATO has created this blowback and led to all kinds of excuses for recent Russian imperialism, it's also the aspect of it that I think doesn't get a lot of coverage, particularly on the left, is the extent to which the Putin model of government, which he is sort of exporting to Crimea, it's basically run by gangsters, and he had a gangster and a kleptocrat running Ukraine, not that the predecessors were much better, but the people booted this guy out. He supports those kind of crooks in Belarus. It's run by a thug. He's just invited the North Koreans to celebrate the end of World War II in Moscow, which the Germans turned down an invitation to. He supports a murderous kleptocrat in Syria, Assad, and so on. Egypt's Sisi, Tajikistan's Rahmon, you go on and on. So what's happened to the left in general? Because the left used to be the champions of human rights, I recall, particularly with the wars in Nicaragua with the Contras and in El Salvador against the death squads. But now I hear continually excuses for Gaddafi, for Assad, for Putin. What happened to the left?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there was always one part of the left which was always skeptical of human rights, that saw human rights as somehow either not as important as economic issues or not as important as other geopolitical issues, power issues. And so they thought that human rights was a distraction, was something that could be used by powerful governments in their own interests. And so they were skeptical of that. So that was kind of one part of the left. But the other part of the left actually embraced human rights quite strongly, pushed for it, and of course was successful during the Carter administration in elevating human rights to basically the top of the agenda, at least for that period of time, short period of time at the State Department. But I think after that, there was a rethinking. If the State Department is going to embrace human rights, even if it's only at a rhetorical level, then perhaps the issue has been compromised in some way. And so I think there is these two trends, the kind of historic segment of the left, which was always suspicious of human rights, and then this rethinking of human rights after it becomes compromised by U.S. official U.S. government interest. There is a tendency, for instance, to see Russia under Putin as basically a counterweight to U.S. power overseas, and that there aren't really any other major counterweights like Putin. I mean, if you look at China, for instance, it's a potential counterweight, but the United States and China have such a strong economic relationship that it's difficult for China to oppose the United States so thoroughly. Other countries simply don't have the military, either the potential military or the current military strength to challenge the United States. So what's left? What's left is, some concerns coming from the European Union, but the European Union is our partner. Some concerns coming from the United Nations, but the United Nations is a relatively weak international organization. So this analysis of geopolitics then identifies Putin and Russia as really the only effective counterforce. Now, to be honest, though, Putin and Russia really aren't a counterforce. I mean, yes, Putin and Russia are worried about NATO expansion. And so, yes, in that sphere of influence around Russia, known as the near abroad, there is this kind of pushback against, certainly against NATO expansion, certainly against the kind of projection of U.S. power or of allied coalition power in that region. But beyond that, Russia either is not interested in pushing back against the United States or is perfectly happy with U.S. power projection, for instance, against Islamic fundamentalism or terrorism and the global war on terror. That's certainly something that the Kremlin is very enthusiastic about these days. And in fact, it's when the United States deviates from its focus on the war on terror. In other words, when it supports democracy movements in Egypt, leading, for instance, to the election of the Muslim Brotherhood, or when it supports anti-Assad campaign in Syria, that's when Russia gets upset. As long as the United States maintains its focus on the global war on terror, it's going to be able to count on the Kremlin as a partner.
And again, I'm speaking with John Pfeffer, who's the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously, he worked as associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. His books include Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy After September the 11th and Crusade 2.0. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Kremlin's Kool-Aid. And in your article, you talk about having this argument at a restaurant with a prominent person who was expressing very, very strong pro-Russian views when you criticized Putin, and you described it, since you've lived through the Cold War, as a sort of reverse of Alvin Toffler's future shock. It's past shock. I recently had a dinner with some friends, one of whom said, "I'm rooting for Putin." And I tried to find out from him what he meant, and he basically, there's a sort of reflexive anti-Americanism, I think, in the European left and in the American left that, you know, feels that somehow America needs to be taken down a peg or two. I could not get any clarity. But what's your understanding about that impulse, that that because you're angry at the U.S., you sometimes blind yourself to what's even worse?
Well, it could be very well generational, and it would be interesting to see some polling on that. And my sense is that, you know, younger generation just doesn't think quite this way. That, you know, let's take, for instance, the hit series right now, House of Cards, which is a pox on both houses kind of approach. You have an absolutely ruthless American president and an absolutely ruthless Russian president. And, you know, they basically go head to head in trying to prove who's more ruthless and cynical. And I think in some sense that would be, you know, a generational outlook on the situation in geopolitics today, whereas folks who, you know, came of age in the Cold War, just to one degree or another, we all still have some element of Cold War thinking embedded in us. We still think in terms of us and them on either side of the Iron Curtain. And so many of the issues that we currently are dealing with still kind of have a lingering whiff of that mentality. In other words, if we're talking about nuclear weapons, for instance, well, I mean, how are we going to actually deal with the question of serious reductions in nuclear weapons unless we deal with Russia? I mean, it's not going to be something that the United States, frankly, is going to do by itself, even if we want it to, even if it makes sense, even if we have the so-called four horsemen saying that we should be engaged in serious nuclear disarmament. It's still going to be something we have to engage with the Russians on. And so engaging with the Russians already brings us back into this kind of state of play that existed 25, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And many of the associations, at least people of my generation, have with that are Cold War associations. I think it's very difficult to break with that. But as I said, you know, my hope is that we have a new generation of people, at least here, possibly in Russia, who are thinking differently.
Well, my friends in Russia, and I'm sure you have friends there as well, they are just feeling absolutely bereft and squeezed. And the, you know, the educated, the entrepreneurs, you can't be an entrepreneur in Putin's Russia anymore because he's the Siloviki, he's crooks and cronies come like protection racketeers and tell you that, you know, we're your new partner. That happened to the founder of Russia's Facebook, VKontakte. And now the Kremlin crony owns it. This is a sad reality. People are trying to get out of that country in droves. But you describe in your article going to a conference in Toronto on Ukraine, where basically the crowd was divided between those who were screaming about the fascists in Kiev and those that were screaming about the imperialists in Moscow. If the argument goes down along those lines, we're obviously getting nowhere. And it is a very difficult thing to navigate. We've never had this phenomenon of a combination of national security and organized crime, the mafia and nuclear weapons that Putin represents. On the one hand, he presides over a gangster state and they're stealing the country blind and prosecuting a war next door to distract people from the kleptocracy that Putin runs. And he's absolutely got the entire Russian population beguiled and in love with him. I mean, he may actually be in bad health. That's the latest reports we hear. But at the end of the day, how do you deal with this situation? Because on the one hand, you know, you could call the guy a gangster, which I've just said, but that doesn't help. But on the other hand, he reminds us of how many nuclear weapons he has. So what do we do going forward?
Yeah, I mean, it is a difficult question. And let me first start with Ukraine, because that, of course, is the question that's on many people's minds at the moment. And, you know, there was a recent poll that came out from PIPA here and the Project on Public Attitudes here in Washington, D.C., that was done in conjunction with folks on the ground in Ukraine. And the results are not as polarizing as you might think, which is important, because if we go just by the voices we hear, say, in the audience of a conference, or the comments we see online, or, you know, the shouting matches that sometimes take place, you know, on our TV stations, then we would think that things are really just it's irreconcilable, that the positions are so strongly held. But if you look at this polling data from Ukraine, you find that there's actually considerable gray area, shall we say. In other words, there are a lot of people in Western Ukraine who are hesitant about moving too quickly to join either the EU or NATO. And there are plenty of people over in eastern Ukraine who are very hesitant about moving too quickly into the Russian sphere of influence. In other words, there is, I think, a possibility, if we can stop the fighting in Ukraine for a long enough period of time, for some process of, shall we say, rebuilding of the country to take place. Now, that may involve some aspect of what's called a frozen conflict, in other words, sealing off, cordoning off a section of eastern Ukraine and having its not exactly part of the territorial integrity of all Ukraine, in much the same way as Abkhazia or South Ossetia in Georgia. But I would hope that would be a temporary situation. So that's Ukraine. In Russia itself, well, as you said, Putin is very popular. His popularity rating is above 80% at the moment. And I think one of the reasons, and this is something we really have to address, it's true that he is a gangster and he presides over a gangster state, but you know the Russia had fallen so dramatically in its economic capacity during the 1990s. The standard of living, the very demography of the country, the population decreased, the standard of living, of course, decreased, but even the age to which people were living decreased, which was the most remarkable drop in a modern country in modern history. And so Russia had fallen so far during the 1990s that the modest improvements that Putin was able to usher in, and much of it the result of simply rising energy prices and the ability of Russia to sell its energy on the world market and to distribute that even to a small degree, was important. You know, it was very important for how people viewed the central government and how they viewed central authority. Now, it's true that if you travel around Russia today, you will find large parts of the country that are basically at the same level as sub-Saharan Africa and other parts of the country which are at the same level as some of the richest parts of Western Europe. It's an extraordinarily polarized environment there, not only across the territory, but, of course, between economic classes in general. And that's the kind of system that Putin presides over. But because he was able to deliver a measure of success over the last 10 years, that explains his popularity. In order for the opposition in Russia to gain some kind of foothold, it's going to have to reckon with that. It's going to have to provide something concrete to Russians. It's not just anti-Putinism, because he's too popular, that's not a sufficient message. They have to provide an alternative, an economic, a political, a foreign policy alternative that actually delivers something, something that is concrete. So I think that's in some, but that's a long-term strategy. That's not something that's going to happen tomorrow or next week.
Right, and the opposition, the leaders of the opposition are all in jail, and one of them just got murdered. So it's pretty hard to organize an opposition when you're under those conditions.
Absolutely.
Well, just in closing, John Pfeffer, what would you like to say to our audience, which is very, very left-wing, and a lot of them watch Putin's propaganda channel, RT, which I find to be quite pernicious, but that's just my opinion. What are you trying to say, essentially, in your article at the Huffington Post?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's important to be able to keep two things, at least, in mind at the same time. In other words, a critique of U.S. foreign policy, a critique of NATO expansion, and at the same time, a critique of Russian policy. They're not contradictory. We should be able to hold both of those in our head at the same time. What that means in terms of going forward, in terms of U.S. foreign policy, well, it's, number one, to be very, very careful about what NATO's moves are in Eastern Europe. And in the former Soviet Union, in the Baltic countries, for instance, which are members of NATO. Be very careful about that. Number two, recognize that Russia, like any country, has legitimate national interests that go beyond its borders even, just as any European country, any Asian country, and certainly the United States, articulates its national interests. And at the same time, we have to be very clear that the direction of Putin's policies right now are on the extreme right end of the political spectrum, whether we're talking about militarism, whether we're talking about social policy, whether we're talking about his economic policy. And if we want there to be a Russia in the future that is answerable ultimately to the people's needs and their desires, we're going to have to see something other than Putin. We have to see the political spectrum shift far more to the center from the right-hand side of the spectrum, and then someday, we hope, move in the direction of the left as well.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, John Pfeffer.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
And again, I've been speaking with John Pfeffer, who's the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously, he worked as an associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. His books include Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy After September the 11th, and Crusade 2.0. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Kremlin's Kool-Aid. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.